From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The Trump administration is awaiting the results of Saudi Arabia's investigation into the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi. The president said yesterday that if Saudi Arabia murdered the journalist, there would be very severe consequences. And that would be welcomed by a bipartisan group of senators, 11 Republicans and 11 Democrats, who've triggered the Global Magnitsky Act and called on the president to start an investigation to possibly put sanctions on Saudi officials. The law was named after Sergei Magnitsky, who died in a Russian prison in 2009 after he exposed government fraud. He was a lawyer for American William Browder, and Browder is now the head of the Magnitsky Justice Campaign. William Browder, welcome.
Thank you.
We have to explain your backstory here a little bit. You were an investor in Russia. Sergei Magnitsky was one of your tax lawyers. He died after he was tortured in a Russian prison. You then push Congress to pass the Magnitsky Act, and that is the law that these senators are now using to call on President Trump to investigate and impose sanctions on the Saudis who are believed to be responsible for Khashoggi's death. How much pain would that inflict?
Well, the Magnitsky Act basically has two functions. It freezes the assets and bans the visas of people who are sanctioned under it. And in particular, what it does is it puts people on something called the U.S. Treasury OFAC sanctions list. And what that means is that if you have money anywhere in the world, no bank will move your money anymore after you get put on that sanctions list. So it doesn't even matter if you have money in America. If you have money in a Dubai bank or in a Chinese bank, that bank doesn't want to be in violation of U.S. Treasury sanctions and your money gets frozen. And these guys in Saudi Arabia who are accused of murdering Khashoggi have a lot of money and have that money all over the world. This would be a devastating shock for them if they get added to the Magnitsky list.
But the law still leaves the decision to impose those sanctions up to the president, even if the senators have invoked it. And the president has been very hesitant to threaten his relationship with the Saudis. Do you have any faith that President Trump will be willing to act?
Well, he's in a very difficult position right now because on one hand, he has some type of irrational love for the Saudis. On the other hand, we have a situation where Jamal Khashoggi, a Washington Post columnist, was chopped up into little pieces and carted out by 15 Saudi security agents, some of whom are pictured all over the world traveling with the crown prince. The level of granular evil puts him in a terrible position if he wants to not do these sanctions, because it looks like then he's involved in a murder conspiracy to cover up the responsibility of the Saudis. And I don't think that politically that's a place where he can be, no matter how much he loves the Saudis.
You think that pressure might be enough?
I've seen it. It's overwhelming for him. And it gets worse for him because at any point, if he tries to justify not doing things by sort of latching on to some of their own theories, he then looks like he's part of the cover-up. And I don't think that he wants to be there. And that's not a good place for him to be politically.
Well, the reporting is now that the Saudis are getting ready to put the blame on Major General Ahmed al-Asiri. Now, this is someone who is very close to the crown prince. Do you think that that will keep even higher ranking officials immune from Magnitsky sanctions?
Well, so the problem for the Saudis, the problem for Trump, is that we're in a world of ever flowing information. And so they may try that, and it just doesn't work because the information just flows too freely. And so I don't think that anyone can control the way this thing unfolds. And I think that as information comes out, it's going to become more and more damning for the Saudis.
If we look at the history of this law, sanctions have been used 49 times under Magnitsky. What are some of the key cases in your mind?
Well, there's two types of Magnitsky sanctions. There's Russian Magnitsky sanctions, which are related to the murder of my lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky. And then there are global Magnitsky sanctions. And the 49 names that you're talking about are the specific Russian Magnitsky sanctions. And there's roughly 83, I believe, names of people and companies under the global Magnitsky sanctions. And under global Magnitsky, they've sanctioned a bunch of Burmese generals that were involved in the genocide of the Rohingya people. They've sanctioned Venezuelans, people from South Sudan. And up until now, it's always been sanctioning people who are relatively politically unprotected. And what makes the Saudi situation so interesting is that Saudi Arabia, being a sort of close ally of the United States, now puts a close ally in the firing line of these sanctions, which are truly devastating and something that every person who's sanctioned and every government that's close to them really gets mad at when it happens.
Look, I want to give you a chance to weigh in on how all of this has affected you personally. Sergei Magnitsky was your lawyer. Since he died, you've made finding some kind of justice for him a big part of your life. How is this news about Jamal Khashoggi affecting you?
Well, the first thing that I thought was it just reminded me of everything. This was a very similar situation. He was a critic of the regime. The regime didn't like him. They then ended up then killing him and then trying to cover up the murder. And that's exactly what happened to Sergei. And so my first reaction was like, you know, deja vu. And then my second reaction was that we now have a tool that we created in the legacy of Sergei Magnitsky to punish people involved in extrajudicial killings. I'm really glad that the Magnitsky Act exists, and I'm really glad that members of Congress on both sides in a bipartisan way have gravitated to this to say, okay, we have a tool. Let's use it, and let's use it aggressively against the killers of Khashoggi.
That's William Browder, head of the Magnitsky Justice Campaign. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, Twitter has now waded into the debate about what happened to Khashoggi. The company has suspended accounts of bots that shared tweets in favor of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Joining us now is Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. She's in Washington for our social media roundup. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
So along with suspending a network of bots with pro-Saudi government messages, Twitter has also suspended bot accounts that published critical tweets attacking Khashoggi. What's the company saying about this crackdown?
And it's not necessarily the content of the tweets that's gained the suspension. It's just the nature with which they were being shared. So a number of tweets were being shared in the same way that spam is shared. So exactly the same tweet copied over a series of days or hours, linking into current trends of Twitter hashtags. So that was exactly the behavior that you would expect from spam or bots, which is why Twitter suspended those accounts. The kind of things that were being tweeted and trending right now. From the Saudi perspective, which is fascinating, unfollow enemies of the nation was one of the biggest trending hashtags, obviously in Arabic as well as English. And what's interesting about this, Jeremy, is that there are double tweets and double hashtags. So you'll get the hashtag in Arabic and you'll also get the hashtag in English. Obviously, reaching out to a Western audience. So, for instance, Tariq tweets, "I stand with Saudi Arabia. We have never been so united at this time. Fake news, no matter how thin you slice it, it's still baloney." Gives you an idea of, you know, he's talking to Americans right there. Talking to Americans.
Well, but also social media in Saudi Arabia is highly monitored. So it'd be easier in that country to be tweeting, pro-king.
It would be in your interest to tweet. Yeah. Positively for the Crown Prince because negative tweets are looked at and also monitored.
Okay, so here in the U.S., we're 18 days away from the midterm elections. A lot of states are closing in on voter registration deadlines, and Elle Magazine is now apologizing for some clickbait it shared on social media involving Kim Kardashian and Kanye West that when you clicked on it, it linked to a voter registration site.
And other celebrities. This is, I don't know whether to say this is prime clickbait or the worst clickbait I've ever seen. It was a list of celebrities, and it looked like absolutely classic Hollywood news that would be spread around. So there was one that said, Tim tweets out, "Wow, I can't believe this is why Ariana Grande and Pete Davidson split up." And then there's a link. And then you think, oh my goodness, why did they split up? Because you care about them.
Right.
You click on it and then it says, "Time to vote." And you have so been had.
But there have also been a lot of other companies, social media giants, Facebook, for example, that are trying to get people to vote as well, to register to vote as well. I see the ads right on my Facebook page.
Right across of Facebook and also various social media, Snapchat, Instagram as well. Lots of the social platforms are trying to get people to register to vote, to engage in the political process. Just one bit of pushback here from Daryl Woke, who was upset about the L trick. And she said, "This is actually insulting to women because why use clickbait bait for voter registration? Do you assume that readers of L magazine aren't smart enough to understand the importance of registering to vote?" And I love the fierce response from Ashley Marie Preston, "And people registered, you're welcome."
Well, but I am sort of wondering whether this is going to make a difference. It might this time, you know, to have all these...
One of the issues with voting or not voting, Jeremy, as you know, is that a lot of young people are not engaged and they don't care. So if you go to the platforms where they play, where they work, and you entice them in, they're registered to vote. So come voting day, they can vote
and
if they are
registered.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, before we could let you go, Femi, I just have to tell you about this survey that Chapman University did. We're coming up on Halloween, and it put out its annual survey of American fears.
Yes.
The top thing that people are afraid of... corrupt government officials in this survey.
That was so weird. Because in the middle was people that I love becoming seriously ill.
I know, you
or
would
dying.
Think that would be higher up than corrupt government officials. Also,
I would
and there
think
was,
it would be at the top.
They were worried about pollution of oceans, rivers, and lakes. But way down on the list, number 90.
Yes.
Clowns.
Oh, it's so creepy. Jeremy, are you scared of clowns?
I'm not.
Okay.
Are you?
No.
Okay. Well, maybe you will be after this music. Femi Okeh, the stream from Al Jazeera. Thank you.
You're welcome.
President Trump's rally in Mesa, Arizona today is the latest stop as he makes the rounds now less than 3 weeks before the midterm elections. He was in Missoula, Montana yesterday, and last weekend he was in Richmond, Kentucky, stumping for a Republican who has found himself in an unexpectedly tight race. Representative Andy Barr of Kentucky's 6th Congressional District is facing a challenge from a military veteran, Democrat Amy McGrath, and Democrats have high hopes for that seat. Rylan Barton is a State House reporter for Kentucky Public Radio, and he joins us for this week's District Profile. Rylan, this district is in the northeast part of the state. It includes Lexington, and President Trump won it by 15 points in 2016. What else can you tell us about it?
Sure. So it extends from Kentucky's second largest city, Lexington, over to the foothills of Appalachia, includes kind of a mix of urban and rural areas. It's kind of gone back and forth between sending Republicans and Democrats to Congress over, say, the last 30 years. Hmm. Andy Barr, the current congressman, was first elected in 2012. He replaced a Democrat who had been there for a couple terms.
All right. Let's listen to Andy Barr. Here's a recent ad.
To grow our economy and create more opportunities, I voted for middle-class tax cuts. The average family in Kentucky will get over $2,000 more in their yearly paycheck, and that's money you can use to save, invest, or spend on whatever you need.
So Congressman Barr is touting his record with tax cuts. What else has he done over the years? What do voters know him for?
Beyond the tax cuts bill, which has been kind of the main conversation driver of this election season for him, it's also been he really pushed for rolling back the Dodd-Frank consumer protections. So he was part of that bill, which passed out of Congress earlier this year. He was saying that it was something that really affected local banks and that kept them from basically being able to get lines of credit and affected folks, like especially rural farmers and folks in rural parts of the state.
And this is rolling back the regulations that were put in place, Dodd-Frank, after the financial crisis, right?
Exactly. Barr is he's really supportive of the president. That was kind of the question as to whether or not he would, in this purple district, run away from the president, because there's been a whole lot of anger over the last couple years, especially over Republicans' attempts to repeal and replace Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And he's had some really loud and angry town hall meetings where people showed up. Kentucky's one state that really embraced the Affordable Care Act. Over 500,000 people got health coverage, both through the expansion of Medicaid and through getting insurance through the Obamacare exchanges. And he's really held his ground on that. He says he still wants to repeal more elements of the Affordable Care Act, and he stands by his vote last year in favor of the attempts to repeal it.
Now, that's an issue, actually, that his opponent, Amy McGrath, is trying to use against him. She's a retired Marine fighter pilot, and here's a recent ad from her campaign that shows her going through a day trying to wrangle her three young kids, get them to the doctor.
I flew 89 combat missions as a U.S. Marine, and my 90th mission is running for Congress to take on politicians who put party over country. But some days, this is my toughest mission. I think healthcare is a fundamental right that should be guaranteed.
What else can you tell us about Amy McGrath?
So retired Marine fighter pilot. She's the first woman to fly an F-18 into combat. And she's really seen as Democrats hope to kind of flip one Republican-controlled district in the country in their favor. You know, she's prided herself on really trying to get out into rural parts of the district. Kind of the assumption is that a Democrat's going to do well in Lexington, the urban center of this district. But, you know, historically has not done so well out in rural areas. And so she's really been trying to push her campaign out into the rural parts. It's most evident last week she brought former Vice President Joe Biden out to a rally in Owingsville. It's a town of about 1,500 people. And, you know, a whole bunch of people from there and all around the district came to see the vice president.
Now, the thing about Amy McGrath is she's raising a lot more money than Andy Barr. She's raised about $6.5 million since the campaign started. Barr's at about $4.5 million. How much of a factor will that be? And is a lot of outside money starting to trickle into this race?
There's certainly a lot of outside money. There's a lot of nationwide interest in this race. I mean, at this point, they're kind of neck, or at least in terms of the amount of money that they have on hand, they're pretty much neck and neck. And so at this point forward, we're just going to kind of expect to see a lot more television ads. And it's really like a voter turnout game at this point. How well are they going to be able to get their people to come out to the polls when it really matters on November 6th?
And what do the polls say? We're just a couple weeks away now from Election Day.
There seems to be a new poll every week or two, and they kind of – they're all pretty much toss-ups. It goes back and forth a little bit. There's no way to really say that one person has an edge. If either one does, they have a very slight edge. And really, it's something that could change just depending on who ends up showing up on Election Day.
So Kentucky's 6th congressional district will be one of those key places people are watching to see if Democrats can take a seat from Republicans and flip the House in the Democrats' favor. That's Ryland Barton, State House reporter for Kentucky Public Radio. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
The TV show The Conners premiered this Tuesday on ABC. It's a new version of the famous sitcom Roseanne, but without Roseanne Barr. ABC revived Roseanne last spring. The show was a hit. It was canceled, though, after its star tweeted racist remarks. Now the rest of the cast is back together for a second try, and NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us to talk about it. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So the first episode is a send-off to the character, Roseanne Conner. We learned that her character died of an opioid overdose. Here is a clip of her sister on the show, Jackie, who's played by Laurie Metcalf, talking to John Goodman's character, Dan, which is Roseanne's husband.
I just got a call from a friend in the coroner's office. The autopsy found that it wasn't a heart attack. Roseanne OD'd on opioids.
Not possible. We knew she had a problem. She was only on pain pills for 2 days after surgery. Then it was just ibuprofen. It's got to be wrong.
So Roseanne Barr released a statement after that episode aired, calling the decision to kill off her character this way grim and morbid. What do you think?
I think she's right, but I also think the storytelling worked. So they had foreshadowed that Roseanne Conner, the character, would be struggling with an addiction to pain pills. And so if they're going to kill off the character, to do it in this way makes a lot of sense for the character, and it also hooks it into all of these issues about people being underinsured and the working class folks struggling to deal with medication. All of this stuff that the show wants to talk about, I can now talk about because of the way that the Roseanne Conner character passed away.
All important issues. The question is, who saw the show? And we're seeing that the ratings for the premiere of The Conners were down to just 10.5 million compared with 18 million people on average who tuned into Roseanne when it returned last March.
Right. But there's a few things going on there. I mean, number one, there was an intense amount of publicity when Roseanne, the revival, was debuting. And then you also had news that the Roseanne Conner character was going to be a Trump supporter. And I think that fueled a lot of talk about the show. So I think it kind of made sense that it would do this huge number. Now, over the course of its run, it did an average of about 18 million viewers. So I don't think the Conners is going to get to that level. But it's drawing about the same audience that Roseanne, the revival, was doing when it ended its run in May. And then it's going to be their challenge to kind of build on that audience and retain people who may have just watched The Conners out of curiosity to see what happened to Roseanne's character.
But they're avoiding more partisan politics in The Conners than they did in Roseanne.
I've seen two episodes of the show, and for those two episodes, it certainly seems that way. You know, originally, if you remember the original version of Roseanne, that was a show that tried to talk about all of the different issues that faced a working class family, mm-hmm. and it wasn't quite as partisan. I mean,
yeah, I have to say, I watched that show a lot when I was growing up, and I never thought of it as a political show at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think it actually was a political show. It just wasn't about a particular political party. So now the show is kind of back to what it was doing before, which was trying to explore these issues with an idea towards, you know, breaking down some of the stereotypes that people might have about working class families and talking honestly about the issues they face. And they're also talking a bit about gay rights because one of the characters came out during the episode. And I think we have a clip of that. Let's check it out.
Grandpa Dan, did you ever like a boy?
No.
Does it bother you that I do?
No. I was kind of waiting for you to tell me about it.
Sorry I took so long.
Okay, don't let it happen again.
So now this is interesting because the character is basically Roseanne's grandson. He seemed to dress in kind of an effeminate way in the revival, and they had an episode that kind of dealt with that. But I think they were sort of insistent that he wasn't necessarily gay. Now they have this character saying that he is gay, and that continues along a tradition that Roseanne, the original series, had of exploring these kinds of issues in an honest way.
So, Eric, when I hear John Goodman there and we talk about Laurie Metcalf, we've got two people who weren't as big stars as they are now when the first Roseanne was on the air. Now they're big stars in their own right. Do you think that they're going to hang around and continue to do this show, given that they're big stars in Hollywood generally?
Well, given what I've heard about what they're getting paid, yeah.
They'll stick with it.
Because they're making a lot of money. Uh-huh. One figure I'd heard was something like $300,000 an episode. So, yeah, I think they're going to keep doing it. The irony of this current situation, the way they originally set up Roseanne was that they knew that Roseanne Barr wasn't an experienced television performer, so they wanted to surround her with high-quality actors. And so now what we see is that Roseanne Barr kind of built a sitcom machine that's good enough to survive her departure. And that is kind of amazing. Now, will the audience keep showing up to see this family? That's the open question. But if it keeps doing 10 million viewers, I'm sure ABC will keep doing the show. And I have a feeling the stars will want to keep doing it too.
It's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Heavy rains have triggered devastating floods this week in central Texas. A bridge was washed away outside the town of Kingsland on Tuesday, and homes were flooded in several other towns northwest of Austin. The governor has declared a state of emergency in 18 counties. At least one person has died, and more rain is in the forecast. Mose Bouchel is a reporter at KUT, and he joins us now from Austin. Mose, how much damage have you seen out there?
It kind of depends on where you go up and down the river, but what happened here, this is a river flood, and so homes and properties that were closest to the river have, in certain parts of along the Llano and Colorado rivers, have been flooded out. Now, obviously, there was this really dramatic event earlier this week where you actually had a bridge get taken out outside of Kingsland, Texas, actually the main bridge into town there. And then on down the river, as I said, homes flooded out, neighborhoods evacuated. In the town of Marble Falls, I visited an emergency shelter a few days ago where people had to spend the night after leaving their homes. It's pretty dramatic. And again, it really because it's a river flood, it's concentrated along this waterway for the most part.
The area has this ominous nickname, Flash Flood Alley. Why is that? Why is it so susceptible to flooding?
Our geography and our weather. This is also known as the Texas Hill Country. And so there are a lot of creeks and streams that run through this part of Texas. And when we get massive rain events, those things can fill up super fast. A creek that might have been dry all year is suddenly feels like a raging river, and it can become highly dangerous. Now, in this case, as I said, we're actually seeing a kind of a river flood where we had a lot of rain in a river basin that was kind of to the northwest of Austin, and that caused this massive surge of water to come down these rivers, and now they've reached this reservoir that is above Austin, and which is a flood control reservoir, and so that's kind of containing and trying to release the flow of what was this historic flooding event on the river.
Now, the water level at Lake Travis outside of Austin is at about 700 feet. And if it keeps going up just about 14 feet, officials say the water will start to flow uncontrolled from that dam. What's the danger there for the people downstream?
So that's where it hits the spillway, right? And there is concern that if water starts going over the spillway, that could endanger properties below it. And part of the answer to that is that we do have added floodgates along the dam that holds in Lake Travis. And what people that manage that river, that lake, are trying to decide is whether they're going to open additional floodgates. That would increase the flow on the river that goes straight through Austin, but it may decrease the lake level, to a more comfortable level.
Last month was the wettest September on record, and it's not over. More rain is in the forecast.
Yeah.
And I was just looking this morning. It looks like at this point through Wednesday. How concerned are people about what's still to come?
I mean, I think in a situation like this now, we've had rains for, it's just been raining for a long time here. Not always heavy storms, but it just feels like kind of a constant drizzle, which isn't always the case in Texas.
Yeah.
Our ground is saturated. Our river system is full. Any more rain right now is of concern.
Mose Bushell, a reporter at KUT, tracking the flooding outside of Austin. Mose, thank you.
Thank you.
Volatility has returned to the U.S. stock market. Wall Street jumped this morning, but it's been a rough couple weeks. A 3% drop last Wednesday, a 1% decline yesterday. Of course, that's nothing compared to what happened 31 years ago today, when the U.S. stock market dropped 22.6%, the largest single day loss in U.S. history. New York Times financial reporter Diana Henriques wrote about what led up to that day and what can be learned from it in her book, A First Class Catastrophe, The Road to Black Monday, The Worst Day in Wall Street History. I spoke with her last September and began by asking her what made her want to dive into this crisis.
Well, talking with younger people in my circle, even younger financial reporters, I was astonished at how little they knew about the 1987 crash. I lived through it myself as a reporter, but the mythology that has grown up around Black Monday is really an amazing monument to Wall Street amnesia, let me tell you. People will tell you, oh, it was no big deal, oh, it was over in a day, it was one and done, and nothing could be further from the truth. So it was I kind of wanted to solve a mystery here. Why has Black Monday been so forgotten? Why have we not recognized what it was showing us and taken that to heart?
Well, why did you start your book where you did in the 70s? Because it seems to indicate that was the beginning of what led to it.
Great question, and I'm glad you raised it, Jeremy. The book opens on the silver crisis, which was a bubble in the silver market. But what was significant about that crisis, which was in the commodity market, far from Wall Street, was the way it quickly leapt the traditional fire breaks. The panic spread from market to market, from the commodity market to the brokerage industry to banks and the various regulators of all those marketplaces barely knew each other's names. So we open on a world where official Washington is still kind of trapped in this delusion that there are all these isolated markets that can be regulated separately. And the silver crisis in 1980 blew that delusion apart for those who were paying attention. And then along the way, I illustrate the repeated occasions when a panic refused to stay where it was supposed to, so that by the time you arrive at Black Monday, you understand that this didn't just pop out of a clear blue sky. This was the culmination of a series of misjudgments, missteps, fundamental changes in how Wall Street worked.
Well, one of the fundamental changes was the rise of electronic trading. How big a role did that play?
It was an enormous role, and it was very unfamiliar to most investors at the time, particularly the Main Street investors, the extent to which computers were speeding the flow of orders into the marketplace at the speed of light. And many of those markets were still operating at what I call the speed of life, not the speed of light. Hmm. They were human markets. They were trying to operate as they had operated for 100 years. And they were overwhelmed by the pace of automated order delivery. In addition, further in the background, in the shadows, beyond even the vision of alert regulators, were the use of computers to devise new and destabilizing trading strategies, to create new financial derivatives that were used in imaginative and unusual ways. So the computer was a tool of the financial engineers who were creating the new products that would so affect trading on Black Monday.
I must say, as you're talking about this, it sounds kind of familiar after having just lived through the crash of 2008. You know, people talking about a lot of fast trading and new products that nobody understands.
You're exactly right. I mean, in 1987, there were these titan investors who used these untested derivatives in computer-driven strategies, and they nearly overwhelmed the balkanized regulatory system. Exactly the same thing happened in 2008. Too big to fail investors using untested derivatives in high-speed herd investing strategies with fragmented oversight. So we're right back where we started, only with exponentially larger scale and risks.
Now, you've brought up the issue of regulators. You talk in this book about Ronald Reagan, who took office in 1981 and was pushing for smaller government, was appointing people who wanted to cut back on regulations. How much responsibility did Reagan and his administration have in the crash in 1987?
Well, it's sort of a mixed bag, Jeremy. Yes, there was a new deregulatory fever in Washington. The way that played out, however, was in skimpy rations for the regulators. So to the extent that the regulatory machinery was understaffed and underfinanced, that was a result of this determination to cut back on big government. But I should point out that after the crash, it was a blue ribbon commission appointed by President Reagan, led by a staunch Republican, Nick Brady, who recommended that we scrap our current regulatory system and put a unified regulator in charge in Washington. So both, you know, the prescription for what we should do and some of the problems that gave rise to Black Monday can be traced back to these political divisions. But I should also say that the Democrats in Congress on the left in the 1980s were not really part of the solution either. They wanted more funding for regulatory agencies, true, but they failed to undertake the serious oversight of these profound changes in the marketplace.
Well, and I wonder if we can ever expect our members of Congress to be able to be good regulators of the financial industry, because it is so complicated. How can we expect them to understand all of these new products enough to oversee?
Well, that's why we need to look at the regulatory structure we have. We don't expect our politicians in Congress to understand nuclear energy, but we do expect them to adequately fund the Department of Energy and make sure that the risks that that agency oversees are adequately taken care of. I think the same thing is true of our financial markets. Yes, they are extremely complex, and yes, they are algorithm-driven, and there's lots of rocket scientists from academia who are making fortunes on Wall Street, and that is arcane and bizarre for a lot of people in the political realm. But they still have the responsibility of making sure that the regulatory agency is appropriately structured, appropriately funded, and appropriately staffed so that it can understand what's happening on Wall Street, even if they can't.
Did you get a better understanding in writing this book of why crashes happen, how something that seems small can get out of control very quickly and spread and cause a market crash?
Yes, although it wasn't a big surprise. You know, we've been laboring for decades under the notion of an efficient market, a rational market where investors make rational decisions and those decisions are incorporated into the prices of securities automatically. I never found that particularly persuasive. I've got too big an appreciation for how people panic in a crisis. But after researching Black Monday, I don't understand how anyone can believe that that's an accurate explanation of how markets work. We're human beings. We bring a lot of baggage to our investment decisions. We get frightened. We indulge in wishful thinking. We ignore the red flags until it's too late. That's the nature of the human mind.
I'm sure a lot of people on Wall Street are going to read your book. What about people who don't work on Wall Street or don't work in the financial industry? What do you want them to take away?
I want them, first of all, to understand that this is not a mom-and-pop market. We're the mice on the elephant's dance floor here, and we need to understand our role. What I hope they will take away from the book is a clearer picture of how today's market works and how we got here. But I also hope they will realize that when the elephants are stampeding and running around with their ears on fire, what they should do, what you and I should do, is stay calm, stand pat, and wait out the storm. And then when the dust settles, call your representative in Washington and demand that we finally get some meaningful action on regulatory reform.
That's Diana Henriquez, whose book is called A First-Class Catastrophe, The Road to Black Monday, The Worst Day in Wall Street History. Diana, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And that day was 31 years ago today. We spoke with Diana Henriquez last September. It's Here and Now.
The Milwaukee Brewers host the LA Dodgers tonight in the National League Championship Series. The Dodgers are up 3-2. And whoever wins that series will meet the Red Sox in the World Series. Game one is on Tuesday at Fenway Park in Boston, and that's where we're going to go for this next story. At every Major League Baseball game, trained experts collect bats, balls, bases, jerseys, and other memorabilia used in games. They're called authenticators, and their job is to protect the league's history and a big source of revenue. Shira Springer from WBUR reports.
It's 90 minutes before the first pitch at Fenway Park. Outside the visitors' clubhouse, Major League Baseball authenticator John Martino goes over the game plan with Houston Astros clubhouse manager Carl Schneider.
Anything special today?
No, just the lineup card and whatever broken bats we have.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Lineup cards and broken bats, the typical remnants of your typical baseball game. But the fact that they played a role in a major league game makes them special, cool in fact, and collectible.
But sometimes we'll do jerseys or with us we do debuts. So if a guy has his first game, we'll authenticate his jersey after the game.
For every game during the regular season and playoffs, MLB's authenticators certify items with tamper-proof hologram stickers. The stickers contain identifying information about the item that's stored in MLB's memorabilia database. The authenticators tag bats, balls, bases, jerseys, pretty much you name it, and MLB will authenticate it. Really, anything, says Michael Posner, director of Major League Baseball's authentication program.
We have authenticated urinals from Busch Stadium. You know, don't take my word that there's urinals from Busch Stadium. Here's the hologram on it where the authenticator went into the clubhouse and put it on there.
So what's the market like for used urinals?
So as it turns out, that urinal was purchased by a urologist for a couple $1,000s at auction.
But it was the money paid for autographs, not urinals, that led Major League Baseball to establish its authentication program. It all started with the FBI's Operation Bullpen in the late 1990s. The sting operation exposed a network of memorabilia forgers. Back then, law enforcement estimated that more than half of autographs for sale were fake, and criminals were making millions. That prompted Major League Baseball to increase its anti-counterfeiting efforts. Posner says the weaknesses in the old system were easy to exploit.
Back in the late 90s, when Operation Bullpen took place, most of, or really the only certificate or any way you got something authenticated was a piece of paper that was a certificate of authenticity. We realized that because that could be forged just as easily as a fake autograph, there needed to be another process, another step that helped protect the fan.
That extra step was the hologram sticker. Every season, baseball's authenticators now hologram nearly 1 million items. But it's not just for the fans. It also protects a lucrative revenue stream. Game-used memorabilia is sold at every Major League ballpark. Major League Baseball won't disclose sales figures, but Posner says authenticated memorabilia is a rapidly growing business. During games, MLB authenticators usually sit in a prime location near home plate. Their seats are so close to the action that you can clearly hear the ball pop into the catcher's mitt. More importantly, from their vantage point, the authenticators can clearly see all the action on the field, especially at the plate where they keep an eye on game-used bats and balls. In the second inning, Houston Astros right fielder Josh Reddick breaks his bat. And authenticator John Martino gets to work.
I'm going to get the bat from the bat boy and hologram it as a game-used broken bat.
Martino heads to the visitor's clubhouse, where the broken bat is passed out the back door.
First, I'm going to record who made the bat, the numbers on it, and anything like that that makes the bat unique, because all that information will be on the hologram information.
Next, Martino takes out an iPad and registers the broken bat in MLB's database of game-used memorabilia. And the broken bat is officially authenticated.
I just give the bat back to Houston, because this will go back with them and they'll sell it at their souvenir shop.
Martino is a former police officer. In fact, all authenticators have law enforcement experience, and they take chain of custody seriously. So seriously that after the Red Sox won the World Series in 2013, Martino collected all the champagne bottles used in the post-game celebration and drove them home. The bottles were too wet to hologram after the big win.
So the next morning, when my wife got up, I said, come with me, I want to show you something. I opened up the car, which smelled like a brewery. And she said, oh, you brought everything home to recycle it. That's nice. I said, no, not quite. But then I took all the items out, dried them off, authenticated them all, and then brought them back to the park.
The playoffs keep baseball's authenticators busy. Given the memories and money at stake, Posner figures that will always be the case.
You know, you build a better mouse, they build a better mousetrap, and then you build a better mousetrap, and you build a better mouse. It's a constant chase, and we're always trying to stay ahead of it.
Major League Baseball's authenticators will keep trying to stay ahead of the counterfeiters as players chase the ultimate piece of memorabilia, a World Series ring. For Here and Now, I'm Shira Springer.
I don't know about you. I'm still thinking about that guy who bought the used urinal. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. In association with the BBC World Service, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.